and Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 26th of April, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week. It's glorious sunshine here where I am, and we are here today to discuss the previous weekend and the week's news that is of interest to nationalists. And as always, I have with me today my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Well, good day to you. I'm absolutely fine, actually. It's been a really glorious weekend. We've had lots of sunny weather. I've been visiting people. We're now entering into a phase where I think nationalist activity will start to increase because, you know, the fact that the lockdown rules are being relaxed and that there has to be life after lockdown, doesn't there? And there has to be life other than the new normal, as is being sort of presented to us by the Wokerati. There's got to be proper life where we can see the interests of our people represented and the interests of our people furthered by political activity on the part of those of us that feel the way we do.
Yes, it's great to have this lockdown finally lifting. There were thousands of people in London over the weekend protesting the last little bits of lockdown that we still have, and it will certainly be good to see nationalists able to meet up again and hold conferences and go camping and all the other things we like to do as nationalists. But we have had some bad news last week as well, some persecution of nationalists. The first one concerns Laura Taller and her husband, Sam Melia. And I'll just read out the message that she has sent. She says, "Hey all, you might have heard about what happened on Wednesday. My husband, Sam, was arrested and we both had all our devices seized. They arrested him for three offences, took him in for questioning and immediately dropped two of the offences. They were hoping to get him to confess to something or find something spicy on our devices. There is nothing there. One of their main concerns was Sam allegedly putting up stickers warning about 2066. They don't want people talking about demographics. We are both okay, but we are struggling to contact people without our devices. I'm very angry at the level of harassment we have both received. I am furious. Actually, we will both attend a stream with our friend Mark Collette at some point over the next week and let you know exactly what happened and answer any questions. Look after yourselves." And this is the way that things seem to be going now. Whenever there is an arrest for something to do with nationalism, the police turn up mob-handed and they seize all the electronic devices in the house, which leaves people without access to their email accounts, without access to their bank accounts, not able to talk to people unless they have actually put their passwords somewhere safe where they can get to. It's going to always take people a few days to get back online again because they're going to have to replace all of this electrical equipment. And the point here about why Sam was arrested, I think, it's not so much what was actually on the stickers, because I believe the stickers have been carefully worded to make sure that the stickers themselves are completely legal. And it's the same with all the information that is available at the Patriotic Alternative website. All the leaflets there are completely legal, but they can become illegal depending on the so-called mindset of the person that is handing the leaflets out or that is putting the stickers up, because the way the law is worded, the law is that it's against the law to have an intent to incite hate. And the important part of that is intent. So what the police do, if they have a suspicion that somebody has an intent to incite hate, it won't be so much the leaflets that they're putting up. It will be what they say in their social media and what they say in their private conversations. And if in their private conversations and their social media they use racial slurs, or if they express hostility towards migrants, then that is all evidence that they have an intent to incite hate. And then the stickers and the leaflets become illegal, even though the wording on the leaflet is completely legal, because it all depends on what intent a person has. So people should not be using racial slurs. And there is an argument to be made that using a racial slur doesn't mean you have an intent to incite hatred. It could just be that you're using old-fashioned language. It could just mean that you've got a sense of humour and you're just trying to be funny. But in the eyes of the law, that is evidence that shows that you have an intent to incite hate. So it's very important. Anybody that is putting stickers up or that is doing leafleting, make certain that you do not use racial slurs and you are not seen to be hostile to minorities in your chats. Now, we are not hostile to minorities. We are critical of government policy. And you'll notice that on these leaflets, it talks about immigration. It doesn't talk about the immigrants themselves. It talks about immigration. It's critical of a government policy. And people must remember that that is what we are criticizing. We are not criticizing the immigrants themselves for coming to our country because we are the ones who invited them to our country. It would be wrong of us to then criticize them for taking advantage of this. It's wrong of us to criticize them for continuing to follow their culture when they come here because that is their culture. That is part of their ethnicity. The people who are in the wrong are the government for inviting them here in the first place, and we have to make certain that that is the point that we are concentrating on. So just to make sure that everybody is safe, just make certain you don't use racial slurs and don't expose hostility in your chats. So obviously it's dreadful that this has happened to Laura and Sam, and I hope they manage to get back on top soon. But people have got to expect that this sort of thing may well happen to them if they are leafleting, if they are stickering, if they become a public figure. Have you got any comments you want to make on that, Max?
Yeah, just to say that anybody that's involved in British nationalism really needs to keep backup copies of any material they've got. And I'm not suggesting that they keep backup copies of any material that's inflammatory, but any articles they've written, any books that they're in the process of writing, or anything of that sort, keep copies of it backed up either in the cloud or keep it, have it kept on premises other than your workplace and your home, basically, so that if you are raided and the police do take away all your devices, you don't lose years worth of work that you've been preparing. and just really just to reiterate what you said, Sven, about making sure that you don't keep inflammatory material on your computer or on any device, and don't use racial slurs when you're using any kind of electronic media or device. The point is, you should never say anything in front of an electronic device or within the hearing range of an electronic device that you wouldn't be prepared to stand up and say in a court of law in front of a judge. If it's something you wouldn't be prepared to do then just don't say it. Say something that's less inflammatory and more moderate. It is possible to explain our cause to other people. It is possible to campaign for our cause without using racial slurs and without using inflammatory language. It just requires a certain amount of discipline and practice. And if you want to see people who are experts at doing this effectively, then you need to speak to people like Laura Towler. You need to speak to people like Mark Collett, and look at the way in which I write, look at the way in which Sven writes, and the way that we speak when we're issuing these broadcasts, because people just think that that we say things without any kind of preparation at all. But I can assure you that the discussions that we hold are practiced and are done so in order to avoid exposing ourselves to the risk of being prosecuted.
Yeah, and when people put their information, if they put it on a USB stick, don't think you'll be able to hide the USB stick somewhere at home and the police won't find it. Make sure that it is on somebody else's premises so that you can then go and pick up your information after this sort of thing happens, if it does happen. And it is happening more and more often here. Now, some people say, well, I have an encrypted chat, but the police can get through into encrypted chats. And it's far better that you just don't use that language and don't express hostility, because then if this does happen to you and the police go through your chats, they will see that you are not expressing hostility. You are not using racial slurs. And those chats can become evidence to support the fact that you are not trying to incite hate. So it can work the other way around. Unfortunately, we had another arrest last week. The co-founder of neo-Nazi group National Action has today been charged with membership of a terrorist organisation. Ben Raymond, 31, from Swindon, has also been charged with three counts of possessing material likely to be useful to a terrorist organisation. Raymond will appear in Westminster Magistrates Court on April 28th. Now, it's awkward to discuss this because National Action are designated terrorists, and we obviously don't want to appear as if we are supporting terrorism or terrorists in any way. But Ben Raymond, as an individual, he's been involved in nationalism for quite some time. He was the former leader of National Action, and he wound National Action up in 2015, or 2016 rather, when it was banned. So people are asking, well, how is it that he could be arrested for membership of a terrorist organisation that no longer exists? Well, the reason for that is the way that the police have looked at this and the way that the law have looked at this. They've looked at what they consider to be the mindset of somebody that was in National Action. And their mindset has sort of things like wants to start a race war, talks about exterminating Jews, things of that sort. So if they can show that somebody has what they call the National Action mindset, that is proof that that person is a member of National Action. They may have never had anything to do with National Action when National Action were an organisation, but they can still be charged with being a member of it today, and it all depends on the mindset that they have. So it looks like what they are saying here is that Ben Raymond continued to have the same mindset that he had when he was in National Action, and he may still have it today. That I think that's why they're saying membership here. Now, this charge for three counts of possessing material likely to be useful to a terrorist organisation, if they can establish that somebody has the National Action mindset, then again, material that could be completely legal in another person's hands may become illegal in their hands. It may just be self-defense manuals that you have, but self-defense manuals talk about how to harm other people. And it could be said that if somebody has this National Action mindset, if somebody has this terrorist mindset, then even manuals to do with self-defense could count as material likely to be useful to a terrorist organization. It could be absolutely anything. It could be something that is completely legal that you can buy in the shops. But if you are a terrorist, you may be able to use that to further your terrorist aims. So what they're talking about here, you just don't know what it is. One thing that it could be is the Anarchist Cookbook. This is something that has come up in quite a few cases. It's completely legal to purchase. You can buy it at Amazon. You can buy it at Waterstones. It's been out about since the 70s. It was known as just an edgy book to have. But if it's in the hands of somebody that has been shown to have a terrorist mindset, then that becomes material likely to be useful to a terrorist organisation. So everybody should be making sure that they don't have any of these books. I mean, you don't need to have books to do with attacking people or other things like that. Maybe Breivik's manifesto. You don't want to have any of these manifestos. You've talked before, Max, about sometimes not even having details on war history. I remember you saying a while back. Do you want to repeat that or talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, I would disagree with you slightly in that I don't think that anybody could construe a self-defense manual as being something. If it was a manual talking about how to attack people and how to disable people, then that would be something that possibly could be construed as being material likely to be of use to somebody preparing acts of terrorism. But I think self-defense is something which you can quite legitimately indulge in, and you could quite legitimately have books on self-defense. The books to which Sven is just referring to are, there are certain books that you can find in bookshops which relate to the tactics employed by military units during the Second World War. And so you can find books that are that detail the tactics of house-to-house fighting, the tactics of how to defend your house against attack by booby-trapping the entrances to the house and things of this sort. So books of that sort, I think they would almost certainly fall into the category of material. Well, I would imagine that the police would be fairly keen to use your possession of that to indicate that you had material likely to be of interest to somebody who's preparing acts of terrorism. So, you know, just don't keep books of that sort, because you're just taking a risk. And, you know, we are, people talk about, you know, some people fear that we might be heading towards a civil war. And that's possibly that, you know, that at some point in the future, that is an event that could occur. But we don't have to prepare for it in that way. Now, what we need to do as nationalists is to try and avert any kind of wartime, warlike situation that might develop in the future. You know, I think anybody who's seen footage of Syria and seen the devastation that occurred in Syria and the loss of life that's occurred in Syria as a result of the civil war in Syria will know that that a civil war is not something that you should look forward to with any kind of relish. A civil war in a country with modern day weapons is something which would cause absolute devastation and immense suffering to people concerned. And so that isn't something that we should relish. It may be that at some future date a civil war might be forced upon us. And if that's the case, then we would need to respond accordingly. But the point is that we are not at that in that situation now. And there isn't any prospect of a civil war breaking out in Britain within the foreseeable future. And so there is no need to keep books of that sort at all. So just don't keep them.
I would also say, I mean, the sort of books that, that you would want to be reading are books on race and IQ, books on evolutionary psychology, books on the South in America in the 18th and the 19th century, racial science from that time. I mean, all these books are fantastic and it will give you a great understanding of the differences between the races. It will give you an appreciation of the differences between the races, and you're not going to get into trouble for having those sort of books, but for having books that tell you how to be an armed revolutionary or setting off devices, things like that, you really don't want to have them. And there is a real difficulty in this day and age with the ease that these books can be got hold of, because you just download PDFs, you see the title and you think, oh, that looks interesting. You download it onto your computer. You may never even look at it. You may not even know that it's there. But then if your devices get seized and the police put their software through it, which goes looking for any books of that type, and it will find them on there, and you may not have even read the book, and it could be used against you. So just be really careful with what you download. And again, we have an instance of this happening last week. A Nazi sympathiser allowed to graduate from Cambridge University despite alarm over his white supremacist views was convicted yesterday under terrorism laws. Mathematician Oliver Bell faces up to 15 years in jail after buying a bomb-making manual on Amazon. But he was raided by counter-terror police after threatening to get a machine gun and go on a killing spree, leading to the discovery of the bomb manual. He was yesterday convicted of possessing a document likely to be useful to a person committing or preparing an act of terrorism. And that so-called bomb manual is the Anarchist Cookbook. It's that book once again. It came up in a recent National Action trial and was used against them. And it's being used against this mathematician. He's been found guilty. And as you can see here, could face up to 15 years in jail for having this book, which can just be bought in Amazon, it can just be bought in Waterstones, but it becomes illegal in his hands because he had made posts where he threatened to get a machine gun and go on a killing spree. So, and I think maybe he may also have made posts about exterminating Jews. Silly things to say on Facebook, and when you add the silly things said on Facebook and in social media, and you add that to him also having this book in his possession, he's now facing 15 years in jail. So these are all things that people can avoid doing to protect themselves. And we can't really talk that much more about this because he hasn't actually been sentenced yet. And we have to be careful when we talk about these cases which have not actually been finalised yet. But have you got any comments you want to make on this case, Max?
Well, just to say that the campaigns by the police will obviously know that the vast majority of people, because I think that there have been a succession of cases where people have been convicted on a technicality on the basis that they've had the Anarchist Cookbook, and they've also said something that has been determined as hateful on social media, and so the police have put these two things together in order to convict them. I think as far as the police are concerned, in many of these cases, the individuals concerned that have been convicted are quite obviously not actually people who are in the process of preparing acts of terrorism. They are just nationalists. And this is all part of a campaign that's been waged by the authorities in this country to discourage people from becoming politically active as far as British nationalism is concerned. But as I said earlier on, it is possible for us to argue for the ethnic interests of our people without using racial slurs, without incitement to racial hatred, and certainly without collecting a library of books that have got information in it which about weapons or gun or bombs or anything of that sort. There's no need to do that. But we do need people to be determined and to be determined to learn how to speak in the ethnic interests of our people. A quotation was brought to my attention earlier on this week, which I think pretty much fits the situation that we're in. And there was there's a famous Welsh poet, Dylan Thomas, who was very emotionally moved as he was watching his father lying on his deathbed. And he felt there was a danger that his father would just give up on life and just slip into death without resisting death as much as he vigorously could. Dylan Thomas wrote this this poem to his father. And there is an analogy here, which is that the authorities and the people who are promoting multiracialism and multiculturalism, they want us to lose the will to fight so that we will just not resist and allow multiculturalism and multiracialism to win. But we must fight. And the key phrases that are in the Dylan Thomas poem to his father is do not go gentle into that good night, i.e. don't just gently surrender to death. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And I think that those words very powerfully represent the attitude that we should have as white people in a world where there are lots of people who are enthusiastic looking forward to the demise of the white race. And I think that we need to decide very firmly not to go gently into that good night, but to rage, rage against the dying of the light, but doing it legally, of course.
This is the thing. It's all to do with staying within the law and the way that you look at it. There's an article at radioalbion.com, which is our stance on anti-Semitism. If you have a look at that article, that gives you an idea of the way that we should be looking at this. We shouldn't be falling into their traps of hating or resenting ethnic minorities for behaving in their own interests. It's the problem lies with us. We are not behaving in our own interests. It's no good whining and complaining that other groups are doing what they can to advance their interests. We should be doing what we can to advance our interests. And how we should be looking at this is that these are our competitors. They are competitors for limited resources within limited land, and we should be looking at this as a competition. And we want our competitors to be as good a competitor as they can, because when we compete against them, that makes us into better people. It's like a challenge. When you're having a race, when you're having a marathon race, you don't want everybody else to be, you know, out of breath and no good at running so that you can completely trounce them. You want them to be as good as you are. You want them to push you to the absolute very limits. And that's the situation that we're in. We've invited these people into our countries. We've made laws to effectively get us to fight with one hand tied behind our backs, and we've made it a real challenge for ourselves, and we should be relishing that challenge. We should be saying, we're white people, we're British, we rise to the challenge, we can beat this, and we can do it within the law, and we can do it within all the parameters that we have put there, because we are the ones that put those parameters there. They're our countries, they're our representatives that set this system up and the situation that we are in now, and we can beat it, and we can beat it still with one hand tied behind our backs, and we can do it without falling into their traps of being a racist, or falling into their traps of being a hater or inciting hate. we can look at it as a really good, strong competition. We've got some strong competition that we are competing against. Our opponents are very, very resourceful, and that's the way that we should look at it. But we can be even more resourceful. We can beat them, and we can beat them mainly through positive ethnocentrism. The more positive ethnocentrism we show, the better, because when all they know how to do is to attack it as if it is negative ethnocentrism. And when they attack it, it just makes them look absolutely terrible. It makes them look awful, and it makes us look even better, and even more people just come to our cause. Now, we don't want to just all talk about negative things. We have got a positive news story to bring up. There was a bit of a pushback against Keir Starmer last week, I believe, Max.
Yes, what happened was that Keir Starmer was on a visit to Bristol. No, not Bristol. It was to Bath, rather. Sorry, he was on an outing to Bath to promote the Labour Party ahead of the elections this year. And when he arrived at the Raven Pub, and the Raven Pub was it still is owned by two men who have been supporters of the Labour Party in the past, but one of the partners took issue with Keir Starmer when they were stood outside the pub, and basically told him in no uncertain terms that he felt that the Labour Party had not supported the interests of publicans, and that publicans effectively had been thrown in front of the bus, that the lockdown rules had very, very savagely undermined the financial well-being of publicans, etc., and he wasn't happy at all. And having expressed these views to Keir Starmer, Keir Starmer then decided that he wasn't going to win an argument against this guy, and so turned to walk away. And the publican was then engaged in conversation by one of the people who was accompanying Keir Starmer. And as soon as the publican realised that Keir Starmer and the two other people that were accompanying him had gone into his pub, he then decided that most certainly he wasn't going to allow Keir Starmer to make use of his pub's services, and wanted him out of the pub. And so he rushed to the door to tell Keir Starmer to leave the pub. And as the videos that are online show, one of the people who was accompanying Keir Starmer stopped him from entering the pub, and then manhandled him around and pushed him into a corner, and then kept him pinned in that corner so he couldn't confront Keir Starmer and tell him to get out of the pub. But the publican, whose name I believe was Rod Humphreys, he wasn't going to allow that to stop him. And so he just shouted at the top of his voice, "Get out of my pub, get out of my pub, you're not welcome in my pub," words to that effect. And eventually Keir Starmer decided that it was not good publicity, and so he'd better leave the pub. And so he turned to leave the pub. The point is that some years ago, when the British National Party was still growing, the then chairman of the British National Party, Nick Griffin, had a habit of going around on his electoral duties accompanied by people who were quite obviously bodyguards, and these were sort of very big hulking guys who were there to deter Antifa people from attacking Nick Griffin. But it was pretty obvious from looking at the video of Keir Starmer that the people accompanying him, well, I say it's pretty obvious, it certainly appeared to me that the people accompanying Keir Starmer were his bodyguards, and the guy who stopped Rod Humphreys from getting back into his own pub, and then who pushed him through into a corner in the pub and kept him sort of pinned there, this guy probably was a heavy of the same kind. He was behaving like a heavy of the same kind that used to accompany Nick Griffin. And so it's interesting that Keir Starmer appears to have taken a leaf out of Nick Griffin's book in terms of having very muscular, very heavily built men accompanying him wherever he goes, in order to physically force anybody who wants to confront him from not being able to do so, basically.
You know, I was really pleased that this Rod actually managed to get up close to challenge Keir Starmer, because they do their best to make certain that they're not going to have any interactions with public that aren't pleased with them. So that was absolutely great. You just came across him in the street and he was saying, "You're not providing a good enough opposition. You're absolutely dreadful." So it's good to hear that he used to actually be a Labour supporter and he feels totally let down by them. But then to see Keir Starmer trying to force his way into the pub, I mean, you really felt for the landlord. I mean, his hospitality is really being abused there, because he obviously doesn't want Keir Starmer in the pub, and yet Keir Starmer is trying to force himself into this man's pub. So he's like, "You're barred, you're completely barred, get out." And they just ignored his wishes. I hope more publicans are going to do that. I do know that in Wales, in North Wales, they said that Mark Drakeford, the leader of the Wales Parliament there, he is completely banned from all the pubs in North Wales. So let's hope that they actually keep to that. And we also see something similar in England, where they ban the people that have ruined their trade from daring to come in their pubs.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out, Keir Starmer didn't actually force his way into the pub. Keir Starmer walked into the pub whilst Rod Humphrey's attention was distracted speaking to one of the people that had accompanied Keir Starmer. But it was the guy who appeared to be a heavy who was with Keir Starmer who then prevented Rod Humphries from getting into the pub to confront Keir Starmer, and then who manhandled Rod Humphries into a corner and then kept him pinned there so that he couldn't actually get close to Keir Starmer to order him out of the pub. But you know, Rod Humphries, such was the strength of his feeling that he just shouted, "Get out of my pub," and then Keir Starmer duly obeyed and wandered off looking a bit shamefaced.
Yeah, you imagine that. You're not allowed to get into your own pub while the person that you are barred is allowed to just walk straight in there. I mean, it was absolutely scandalous what went on there. I think he was interviewed by Good Morning Britain, something like that, and the pub itself, The Raven, I think it's been doing booming trade since then. So if anybody is near Bath, do drop by The Raven and thank Rod for speaking up for the unspoken for, the white working class, I guess you could say. Well, should we move into our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yeah, apart from, I'd just like to just add, I think we, during this discussion we had last week, or perhaps it was the week before, we spoke about the way in which you can tell whether a national leader is loved by their people by the amount of protection they have around them. And I believe I pointed to the fact that the Pope eventually had a Pope mobile so that he could be protected from attacks by the people. And yet there are certain world leaders who stand up in motor cars exposed to the crowds around them, and who sort of drive through if there's a procession or something of that sort. And that, in my view, is a way of determining how well loved somebody is, the fact that they cast their own personal defence to the wind. Effectively, they are prepared to walk amongst the people. In fact, it was in discussion about Prince Philip. We were saying about how Prince Philip championed the royal walkabout, and the point is that when politicians start to walk around among the public with a gang of heavies with them, I think that's an indication really that either that politician is hated by various sections of the population, or that they don't like to be confronted by anybody who's likely to win an argument against them, and so they take heavies with them to push those people away so that they can't they can't embarrass them.
Yeah, I think they all do it now. I think it really started with Tony Blair, didn't it, after the war in Iraq, and then you had Gordon Brown, and there was that woman who he called a bigot, and David Cameron also. So they really don't like to be challenged by the public, basically.
Well, John Prescott had the he was prepared to punch somebody on the nose if they got too lippy or took a swing at him, basically. And so you can have a little bit of respect for John Prescott. But certainly modern politicians are of a different ilk.
He was egged, wasn't he? I think he was egged.
That's right.
Well, let's get into David Livingstone then. We'll start with a recap from last week. We saw Livingstone resign from the Missionary Society after converting just one African, as he saw his calling being in exploring and opening up Africa to trade in the hopes of replacing the slave trade with other products. We heard about his travels up the Zambezi River, which brought back many new botanical discoveries, and we heard how he was the first to cross South Central Africa. His wife tried to join him, but she died, leaving him to press on, despite the bodies of discarded slaves fouling up the wheels of his paddle ship. His final mission was to find the source of the Nile, where he was abandoned by his servants and lost contact with the outside world for 6 years, before finally coming across Henry Morton Stanley, who greeted him with the famous greeting, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." Stanley brought back news of a horrific slave massacre that gave the final impetus needed for the anti-slavery movement to succeed and get Britain to enforce a ban on the trade in Africa. And I just had some thoughts here. I mean, where he was on his own in Africa for 6 years, you imagine that being the only white man in Africa or in that area, and yet he was completely safe. And that shows that the white man was not looked upon as an oppressor. He was not looked upon as being a bad person at all by anyone. And this is at the height of the slave trade, when we're told that all these poor black Africans were being kidnapped by white people and taken to America. And yet you've got this white man on his own in deepest, darkest Africa. And he's not abused in any way. I mean, they did poke fun at him a bit. They put him in a corner and made him eat his food so that they could have a bit of a laugh at him. But he wasn't harmed in any way whatsoever. And I just wanted to point out that this shows that the white man, particularly the British, were respected and were seen as good people. And by the time Stanley actually got in touch with him, Livingstone was in a really bad way by this time, but he refused to actually come back to Britain with Stanley, and he resolved to continue in his search for the source of the Nile. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Just to say, really, that it was remarkable that somebody like Stanley was exploring Africa and on the one hand was searching for the source of the River Nile, which seems to be like quite a sort of academic thing for somebody to want to do, whilst at the same time having as their mission the desire to open up Africa to commerce and civilization and I think that it gets forgotten nowadays by people who have malign intentions towards white people, that there were lots of white people, even those that went out into Africa and into the third world and who were a party to the creation of the British Empire, that there were people amongst them who were motivated by the best of intentions, not only as far as the British Empire was concerned, but also the best of intentions as far as the native peoples that they came across during their explorations.
It was really only the colonising of Africa that did away with slavery. And actually, on the memorial to him, it says Christianity, commerce, civilization. And he saw all those three things as being linked in together. And those three things together would help to put a stop to the slave trade. Well, Livingstone was wrong about the Nile, but he identified numerous geographical features for Western science, such as Lake Ngami, Lake Malawi and Lake Bangweulu, in addition to Victoria Falls. He filled in the details of Lake Tanganyika, Lake Maweru, and the course of many rivers, especially the Upper Zambezi, and his observations enabled large regions to be mapped, which previously had just been blank. Even so, the furthest north he reached was the north end of Lake Tanganyika, which was still south of the equator, and he did not penetrate the rainforest of the River Congo any further downstream than Negatangwe near Masisi. Now, if he'd tried to get into the rainforest, I think he would have died a lot sooner, because he would have had malaria, he had terrible hemorrhoids, he had dysentery. Don't forget, his arm was damaged by being mauled by a lion. I mean, he was physically in a very bad way by this time, but he refused to go back with Stanley. And he saw his mission to abolish slavery as being more important than anything else, more important than finding the source of the Nile, really. And he stated in a letter to the New York Herald, "And if my disclosures regarding the terrible Ugijian slavery should lead to the suppression of the East Coast slave trade, I shall regard that as a greater matter by far than the discovery of all the Nile sources together. And that was written in a letter to the editor of the New York Herald. So he saw his mission as trying to get rid of slavery as just more important than anything else. And he really did succeed in that. It was after the reports of the horrible massacre that we heard about last week. It was after that actually became known in the Western world that they put a stop to it. And what they meant by putting a stop to it was putting a stop to it in Africa, putting a stop to the Africans and the Arabs actually selling these poor folk. While talking about the slave trade in East Africa, he wrote in his journals, "To overdraw its evil is a simple impossibility." He also wrote about a group of slaves forced to march by Arab slave traders in the African Great Lakes region when he was traveling there in 1866. He said, "We passed a slave woman shot or stabbed through the body and lying on the path. A group of men stood about 100 yards off on one side and another of the women on the other side looking on. They said an Arab who passed early that morning had done it in anger at losing the price he had given for her because she was unable to walk any longer. 27th of June, 1866. Today we came across a man dead from starvation as he was very thin. One of our men wandered and found many slaves with slave sticks on, abandoned by their masters from want of food. They were too weak to be able to speak or say where they had come from, and some were quite young." He also described, "The strangest disease I have seen in this country seems really to be broken-heartedness, and it attacks free men who have been captured and made slaves. 21 were unchained, as now safe. However, all ran away at once, but 8, with many others still in chains, died in 3 days after the crossing. They described their only pain in the heart and placed the hand correctly on the spot, although many think the organ stands high up in the breastbone." So you can see he had a good understanding of this, and he was really, really wanted to do away with it and thought it was a terrible trade. And his books and his journals did stir up public support for the abolition of slavery. However, he became dependent for assistance on the very slave traders that he wished to put out of business. He was a poor leader of his peers, and we learned that last week, and he ended up on his last expedition as an individualist explorer with servants and porters, but no expert support around him. At the same time, he did not use the methods of discipline that maverick explorers such as Stanley did to keep his retinue of porters in line and his supplies secure, which could have been the reason why his porters stole them and ran away. For these reasons, he accepted help and hospitality from 1867 onwards from Muhammad Bogarib and Muhammad bin Salah, who is also known as Mupam Marari, traders who kept and traded in slaves, as he recounts in his journals. They, in turn, benefited from Livingstone's influence with local people, which facilitated Mpamari's release from bondage to Mwata Kazembe. Livingstone was reportedly furious to discover that some of the replacement porters that were sent at his request from Ujiji were actually slaves. So we see it's not as cut and dried as Livingstone would want it to be. He is against slavery, but if he doesn't have slavery and he just has servants, the servants run away, they steal all his food, they steal all his medicines, and they disappear and they leave him on his own. Whereas Stanley actually did have slaves, and it was only thanks to him having those slaves that he was able to find Livingstone, and he kept discipline. He disciplined them, whereas Livingstone didn't. And also, this was the economy that they had in Africa. How else were they? The way they looked at it was, how else are we going to survive if we can't sell slaves? There isn't anything else that we can produce. And this is why he wanted to open the continent up to trade and get them producing other things that would then gradually replace the need for them to sell slaves. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just as far as the African slaves are concerned, a lot of these slaves would have been taken from various tribes by other rival tribes. And as we've discussed in the past, prior to the colonization of Africa, the whole continent was covered with tribes, many of whom competed with other tribes and didn't just compete, but were effectively in a constant state of war with the surrounding tribes, where they would massacre those other tribes and where they would take them as slaves if they could and sell them on. And so as far as the servants that that Livingstone would have had a concern. Those servants, many of them would have not had, would have not been steeped in a culture of Christianity, commerce, and civilization. They wouldn't have really appreciated what Livingstone was trying to do, because as far as their early life was concerned, as far as the history of their tribe was concerned, they were in a constant state of war with other rival tribes around them, and so therefore, as a first opportunity, those people, you know, probably would have run away in many cases, and that the only way of stopping them from running away would have been to have employed the same tactics that the Arab slave traders would have used in disciplining the and treating the servants like slaves. And so to a certain extent, it was a there was a process of adjustment that that perhaps needed to go through on the part of the African tribes in adjusting to Western and white concepts of freedom and civil rights, whilst at the same time wanting to advance their own interests in the way that they had traditionally been brought up to, i.e. conducting warfare against any rival tribes around them.
Yeah, I think they would have looked at it as, well, he doesn't own me, so why should we stay with him? And he's feeding us food and looking after us anyway, which is what he does for the slaves, but he doesn't own us, so why should we stay with him? And I think that would have been the mentality that these servants had would have had, because they wouldn't have understood the idea of being paid wages for work or whatever. The whole system was that you were owned by somebody and they took care of all your needs and you took care of all their needs. And as you were pointing out there, Max, this warfare that they had, if they didn't take the other side as slaves, they would just massacre the other side. They would massacre them. In some cases, they would eat them as well. I mean, it was incredibly barbaric, really barbaric. I mean, when we were hearing about how the river was just filled with bodies and the paddle steamer couldn't turn its wheels for all the bodies of the slaves that were there. I mean, it's vile. I was reading about Henry Morton Stanley, and there was one of his retinue that actually paid one of these Africans to cook and eat his slave in front of him, because he wanted to study cannibalism, because these were cannibals that did this. I mean, it, just so barbaric, you know, you just can't really imagine quite how it was. And it was the British that put a stop to that. And if Britain hadn't set these colonies up, if Britain hadn't been colonizers, this African slave trade would have still been going on. It was the colonies that actually helped to put a stop to it. And it was the Africans that were most adamant that they wanted to continue with the slave trade. It was the British that said, no, you're not going to do this. It was the British that paid for the Navy to go all around the world stopping the slave traders. And it's an absolute scandal that today we've got all these institutions that are saying, well, we can't have this anymore because that was linked with slavery, when they should be saying, we are the only people in the entire history of the world that put a stop to this trade. And the very people that wanted to continue it were the people that are today blaming the British for it. I mean, if Africa had had a united system there, they could have just simply made it illegal, but they didn't. Well, after obtaining fresh supplies from Stanley, who afterwards left for England, Livingstone moved south again, obsessed by his quest for the Nile sources and his desire for the destruction of the slave trade. But his illness overcame him. In May 1873, at Chitambo, in what is now northern Zambia, Livingstone's African servants found him dead, kneeling by his bedside as if in prayer. His loyal attendants, Chuma and Susie, removed his heart and buried it under a tree near the spot where he died, which has been identified variously as a Mavula tree or a Baobab tree. That site, now known as the Livingstone Memorial, lists his date of death as the 4th of May, the date reported and carved into the tree's trunk by Chuma and Susie. But most sources consider the 1st of May, the date of Livingstone's final journal entry, as the actual correct one. In a difficult journey of 9 months, the rest of his remains were carried, together with his journal, over 1,000 miles, a journey that took 63 days by Chuma and Susie to the coastal town of Bagamoyo, where they were returned by ship to Britain for burial. In London, his body lay in repose at No. 1 Savile Row, then the headquarters of the Royal Geographical Society, prior to its interment at Westminster Abbey. I just want to point out, this is really good of his servants here, because they were there on their own. They had come out to find him, and they buried his heart there under the tree, which is what he wanted. And then they managed, and then they took his remains a thousand miles to the coast and made certain that he was able to get back to Britain. I mean, there must have been temptations there. I mean, they could have eaten him, but they didn't. They were fairly civilized, these two. So we have to give them credit there, I think.
And that would have been a very difficult thing to do, not just from the point of view of carrying the weight of a body for 1,000 miles, but also, as you can imagine, there would have been no refrigeration in those days. So that body would have been in an advanced state of decay by the time they got it to the coast to ship it to Britain, and it would have been a pretty stinking horrible thing to carry, I would imagine.
That is a really good point there. I mean, that must have been really dreadful for them doing that. So we have to credit them. What do they we say their names were? Chuma and Susie. Yeah. Livingstone made geographical discoveries that vastly expanded European knowledge, and he inspired abolitionists of the slave trade, explorers and missionaries. He opened up Central Africa to missionaries who initiated education and healthcare for Africans, as well as facilitated trade by the African Lakes Company. He was held in great esteem by many African chiefs and local people, and his name helped relations between them and the British. So he set a very good example, really, and helped us out basically when we went back out there, because he had such a good reputation. He may well have influenced Western attitudes towards Africa more than any other individual before him. His discoveries, geographic, technical, medical, and social, provided a complex body of knowledge that is still being explored today. In spite of his paternalism and Victorian prejudices, Livingstone believed wholeheartedly in the African's ability to advance into the modern world. He was, in this sense, a forerunner for not only European imperialism in Africa, but also of African nationalism. And I think we can also look here at his individualism. He may not have been such a good leader of his teams, but as an individual, I mean, that drive to continue doing what he's doing, to stay out there on his own and still keep all his marbles and keep sane and keep working at recording everything in his journal. I mean, he's got some real courage there and strength of will. Within 50 years of his death, colonial rule was established on the continent, and white settlement was encouraged to extend further into the interior. However, what Livingstone envisaged for colonies was not what we now know as colonial rule, but rather settlements of dedicated Christian Europeans who would live among the people to help them work out ways of living that did not involve slavery. Livingstone was part of an evangelical and non-conformist movement in Britain, which during the 19th century helped change the national mindset from the notion of a divine right to rule lesser races to more charitable ideas in foreign policy. And as was pointed out, it was actually this colonizing that helped to put a stop to the slavery. And what they're really saying here is that Livingstone understood he was a white man, and as white men we are supposed to set a good example, and that's why he was saying he wanted Christian Europeans to live among the people so that they set them a good example, so they could see the way that the white man lived, see that it would be more beneficial for them to live in that way than the way that they were. And they had a good example that they could follow. And this was the way that white people thought back then. The slave owners in America thought in exactly the same way. They wanted to set a good example to these people. And they looked on them more like they were children than anything else. And they saw themselves as being adults, and they saw the black Africans as being children, which would be a natural way to look at them. You've got a people that didn't develop writing, didn't put a sail on a boat, they didn't develop the wheel, they didn't develop a lot of things, and they were very very warlike, very savage-like. And if you could just give them the encouragement and show them a good example, then they would be very good people, and they would try to copy the white man. They would copy his rituals. They would get marriage. I mean, they didn't have really marriage in the same way that we had it, but they did in the slavery times, and they allowed them to have marriage ceremonies, and they encouraged them to live in the way that the white man did. And I think David Livingstone, his ideas were very similar here with what he was wanting to do in Africa as far as living among them. But it was through his mapping of the country and through his going up the rivers that made it possible for these colonies to be built, which actually led to the end of slavery. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just to say that I think as far as Livingstone is concerned, his intentions were good, and as far as the Christian missionaries that that he encouraged to go out to Africa is concerned, their intentions were good. I think that they were mistaken, though, in expecting that the Africans would want to live exactly as white people do, and I think that the continuing wars that we have seen in Africa, and particularly the massacres that took place between the Hutus and the Tutus, and the constant warring that there seems to be in the Horn of Africa around Somalia and the countries in that area, what they tend to indicate is that civilization isn't something that can be immediately transferred from one race of people to another. There may be individuals amongst both races who can practice civilization, but I think that to some extent the hopes of people like David Livingstone were naive, and that those hopes really have been shown to have not come to fruition in the way that they probably would have hoped.
I think you'd be very upset to see the state of the world today, and to see what Britain is like, and to see the clash that we have between the different races and the multiculturalism, and how it really hasn't worked out as a benefit to anyone, how it's much better to have people within their own ethnic groups. And I think you're right there, that they have shown that they may not have wanted to be living in this way, because they now have a lot of poverty. They now have a lot of starvation. The wars that they have amongst one another have increased with all these weapons that we have brought them. It would have been better to have just left them be, to develop at their own race, at their own pace, rather. You can't export civilization. Basically, it has to be developed by a people in the way that it has been developed by Europeans. The David Livingstone Centre in Blantyre celebrates his life and is based in the house in which he was born, on the site of the mill in which he started his working life. And remember, he started from a very, very poor background, working 14 hours a day in a cotton mill, and managed to work his way up to exploring Africa. His Christian faith is evident in his journal, in which one entry reads, "I place no value on anything I have or may possess, except in relation to the kingdom of Christ. If anything will advance the interests of the kingdom, it shall be given away or kept, only as by giving or keeping it I shall promote the glory of him to whom I owe all my hopes in time and eternity." And he really seemed to have lived by that, giving away what he thought he should give away and keeping what he should keep. In 2002, David Livingstone was named among the 100 greatest Britons following a UK-wide vote, and he somehow found the time to sire 6 children with his wife in between expeditions. That's incredible. Yeah. You think she managed to make her way out to him, and that was actually how she died. But he still managed to have 6 children. Got any final thoughts on David Livingstone, Max?
I think that what I said just a few moments ago kind of sums up. I think that he rightfully deserves a place as one of the 100 greatest Britons. I think that what he demonstrated was the good intentions of many people who were instrumental in creating the British Empire. But I think that his hopes with regard to exporting civilization were naive hopes, it's just a shame, really, that instead of just cranking back the export of civilization to a rate of export that could be assimilated by the African states, what's happened is that there's been a swing of the pendulum the other way, where there now is no attempt to export civilization to Africa, on the basis that that to do so is sort of paternalistic, and therefore doesn't show respect to the African nations. That what we now see is that there is a continuation of the rivalry between various tribal groups, where the bloodshed is probably just as bad as it was back in Livingstone's days, in that it's bloodshed that's caused by automatic weapons, etc., that Western countries have sold to African countries. And so we shouldn't have allowed the pendulum to swing back as far as it has, in my view, if we really wanted Western standards of civilization to be permanently established in Africa.
I think what it also shows is the drive to actually go into Africa was born out of trying to improve the lives of the Africans, and the colonizing wasn't about trying to get cheap labor. It wasn't about trying to get slave labor or anything like that. It was about doing away with the slave labor, and it was about improving their lives and giving them another economy and encouraging them to make things and trade and to build and to get them to try and do things for themselves, really. And yet we're taught today that it's the complete opposite. And yet when you look at David Livingstone's life, you can see what the motives were. And you can say, and those were the motives of the British. They were noble ideals that they had. It wasn't about enslaving people and getting cheap labour. It was about improving their lives. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
That's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.